Thompson got his start writing for episodes of series such as Out of This World and B.L. Stryker. In 1992, he wrote episodes of a short-lived series called Tequila and Benetti for his Quantum Leap boss, Donald P. Bellisario. While on Quantum Leap, Tommy wrote and became the co-executive producer of the series. Episodes he wrote included Leaping Without a Net, Leap of Faith, Miss Deep South, Future Boy, Southern Comforts, Heart of a Champion, Play Ball, Moments to Live, Nowhere to Run, Killin' Time, Deliver Us from Evil, Promised Land, and Blood Moon. After Quantum Leap went off the air, he wrote episodes of The Pretender, as well as episodes of Sequest, Viper, Dark Angel, Odyssey 5, and Kyle XY. And he was also the executive producer of The Dead Zone, starring Anthony Michael Hall. Mr. Thompson, welcome to the Quantum Leap podcast.
Me? You talking to me?
Yes.
Hey, Albie, how's it going, man? Thanks. It's nice to know that there's still people out there that are interested in the series.
Oh, we love Quantum Leap, and we love talking about Quantum Leap, and the more we can find out about it, the better. And we are just now up to your first episode that you wrote for Quantum Leap.
Yeah, what? I'm trying to remember, was this the second or third season?
Second season,
okay, because I knew it was, you know, when I had written for Burt Reynolds, I had worked for Burt. This is how, do you want me to tell you how it sort of came about?
Yes, I want to know everything, how you got involved with Quantum Leap.
Okay,
and...
well, I was working, we were talking earlier, I grew up in South Florida, and when I was 15 years old, I had a rock and roll band in high school, and I really was thinking that music was, that was where I was going to go. It was like one of those things where nobody in my family was in any kind of entertainment or show business, but since I was like little, I just felt like I got to get into show business. I didn't know where it was going to be. I didn't know how it was going to happen, and actually it did take a number of turns before I finally settled where I did, but at that time, I just started this rock and roll band, and we were actually making some money. We were just teenagers, but we were okay. We were pretty good, and we were getting out there, and I was excited about that. And then on June, June 7th, 1973, I had tickets. It was the last day of school, 10th grade, and I had tickets with some buddies to go see the Eagles that night, and I was going out with this girl that I'd been after for a long time, and so we went surfing after school, because that's what we did. We surfed, and we played music. So we were on our way home, and we got hit by a drunk driver and just tore our car to pieces. And I was in the back seat, and at the time I was bending over to light a cigarette, which I shouldn't have been smoking anyway, but I was. And I hit my head on the back of the seat, and I broke my neck. So they pulled me out of this car, and my life was over as I knew it. I was paralyzed from my neck down. They gave me the last rites. They took me to the hospital. I was in the emergency room, and I remember the priest praying over me and me thinking, like, wait a minute, I'm not going anywhere. I don't know why this guy's doing this, but it was real. It was surreal. It was like out of body, that kind of thing they talk about, and I felt like I was sort of up above it watching it all. And so anyway, I didn't die, which was like, you know, a surprise to everybody, but I was really in bad shape. I was paralyzed from my neck down, and I had no feeling. And so everything I dreamed about, everything I wanted to do in my life was gone at the age of 15. And they ended up going away to this hospital in Georgia, which was the only rehabilitation hospital they could find. It was the end of the Vietnam War, so I ended up in this four-man ward with these three African-American Vietnam vets, and lived there with those guys for a year. And it was a real interesting sort of coming of age. Someday I'll write that story, because it was surreal. It was like you can't even imagine. It was this old hospital that Franklin Roosevelt had built in Warm Springs, Georgia. It had been a polio hospital when he was president, and he basically ran the country out of this place. They called it the Little White House, and it was beautiful. It was up in the mountains, and it was like idyllic, this setting. But it was a growing up time for me. It was, you know, so I was there for a year trying to get myself back together. I mean, I basically came out of there. I regained all the feeling in my body, and I got a lot of movement back. But I came out of there in a wheelchair, and came back to high school the next year, and just had nothing in common with any of my friends. It was just like I had left. I'd traveled to another planet, lived there, sort of changed and then come back to my old home and didn't really know or want to be there anymore. And it was just, so it was all really weird for me and different. I ended up getting out of high school and I ended up with this little bit of money out of this car accident we'd had. I got a little bit of a settlement out of it. So now I'm like, you know, I got married. I married my high school sweetheart. So we're 19. We're married. We have a little baby. And I have no direction in my life. I have nothing. I'm sort of still getting around. I'm getting around then on crutches. And I'm feeling a little better, but I'm still definitely disabled. You know, I'm like, that's going to be my life. You know, I don't know how I'm going to move forward in this life. So I've got this little bit of money, and I read in the paper that Burt Reynolds is building a theater, a dinner theater in my town. And it's like, what? Why is this guy building? He was the biggest star in the world then. It was during Smokey and the Bandit. I read about this theater he's going to build, and I finagle my way into an investor's party. They're having a party there because they wanted some local people to invest. So I get my wife and I get invited somehow to this party, and there's Bert, and like we meet, and something clicked. I mean, he seemed to like me immediately, and of course he was Bert Reynolds, so there was nothing not to like about that. And he said, "Well, why are you here?" And I said, "Well," and I told him sort of a little bit about what had happened to me, and I said, "I have this money, but I just don't. I want to invest it, but I don't want to just be an investor. I go, I need a job. I said, I need." Something to do. I need, you know, and he sort of laughed and he went, okay. He goes, what do you do? And I said, I can do anything. You know, I just was lying through my teeth. And he said, all right. He goes, do you know anything about lighting? And I said, sure. Everything. I know everything about lighting. He goes, all right, well, I'll hire you as my lighting board operator at the theater if you want to do that. And I said, good, let's do it. You know? So I was like, so excited. Now I'm like, I'm in, you know, I'm inside this theater, which is just like maybe the most unique theater of its kind at the time, because it's run by the number one box office star in the world, and he's bringing all his friends from Hollywood down to this basically a truck stop in South Florida, and they're going to do these plays. They're going to do these classic comedies and musicals, and like nobody's ever seen this in where I come from, and I knew nothing about what I was doing, so I sort of was learning on the job, and the very first play we did was start Sally Fields, and it was, you know, it only had like 15 light cues, so it was pretty easy for me to get by. And then, of course, the third play we did starred Martin Sheen, who had just come back from doing Apocalypse Now, so he was like completely out of his mind, and Julie Kavner, and it had like 200 lighting cues, and it was impossible for me to do because I only had really good use of one hand, and I was putting pencils in my teeth, running these dimmer switches, and nobody knew what I was doing up there, but I was terrified. And Bert had directed this play, and I couldn't get this lighting cue right at the end of the first act, and I was panicked, you know, and he's down there, and he's yelling at me, and the whole crew's there, and they're waiting for me to get this cue, and so now I have a decision to make. I'm thinking to myself, I can either just leave, I can walk out the back door, get in my car, drive away, and never come back, or I can just figure this out and get this done. And luckily, I figured it out, and I got the cue, and it was, you know, everything was cool. So I ended up working there for a couple years. Just met the most, just tons of amazing, talented people, and Bert sort of became my sort of mentor, and you know, he used to bring people to meet me, and you know, he'd come over in my booth and say, hey, come over, I want you to meet somebody. And you know, I'd walk over to his little private booth, and there'd be Howard Cosell, or there'd be Farrah Fawcett, or there, you know, Elizabeth Taylor, Dolly Parton. I met like all these people like one-on-one, and it was just exciting. And it was like, okay, now I know I've got to get in this business, because I just, every time I would shake somebody's hand, I would just get electrified by it, you know. But I was like, how am I going to get out of this truck stop? So I met Charles Nelson Reilly, was sort of the in-house acting teacher, and people don't know that Charles is, you know, they know Charles. That people that know him, they know him from game shows, and they know him from some kind of silly stuff that he did. But he was an amazing teacher and an amazing director. He directed a lot of Broadway dramas, and he was just a very talented guy. And he was running this acting program that was connected to Florida State University. So every year, for a year, they'd bring down like 15 acting students from Florida State, which is where Bert had gone to college. And they would basically become slave labor for this dinner theater for a year. They would live there, and they would work there, and they would never leave there. They would just do these plays, and they would build sets. And every once in a while, they'd get to audition for a little part, and they'd get a part in a play, and it was sort of their payback. And it was a great program. It was like, it was beautiful because everybody won, you know. So they let me audit their acting classes. I said, you know, I really think I could be an actor, or I'd like to at least find out if I could be an actor. So they were like, cool, you can sit on these classes if you want, and if you want to work up scenes to do, and we have time, you know. And so that was cool. So I used to sit sort of off to the side, and after the shows were over, and I'd watch these acting classes, which wouldn't start until midnight, and they'd go until daylight. And it was just nothing but, the beauty of it was, it was nothing but creative energy, like, all the time, from everybody. And I found that I loved it. I couldn't get enough of it. So anyway, I'd worked up a scene from the book Catcher in the Rye, which was really my first writing. I sort of adapted this scene out of Catcher in the Rye into a one person little monologue, and I did it for Bert and for Charles and for the rest of the class. So anyway, Bert and Charles were leaving that night to go back to California, and they left after the class. So the next day, I'm running the lights, and the woman that runs the theater comes in to see me, and she says, well, they were very impressed with you. And I said, what are you talking about? She goes, well, on the way to the airport, Bert asked Charles who he thought the actor in the class was, and Charles said the kid on the crutches. And when I heard that, it was just like, okay, you know, if they believe in me, I can, maybe there's something I can do with this. So I started writing stuff for myself to do in these classes. And it was fun, and I was pretty good at it, but it really became obvious to me real quick that because of my disability, that it was going to be so limiting for me. I was just like, I was never going to become a mainstream actor with the situation that I'd found myself in. So I went home, and I found a book in a library about script writing, and I would go home at night and just write scenes just to see if I could do it, And this went on for months and months and months, and I would write scenes, and I'd throw them away. And then finally I wrote this little half-hour script, and I thought it was pretty good, and I gave it to Bert's manager, a guy named David Gershenson, and I asked David, I said, listen, would you just read this, and if it stinks, tell me, and I just need to know the truth, because, you know, I got some decisions to make here, and I just don't know what to do, and if I'm no good at it, I don't want to fool myself into thinking I am. And so he read it, and he called me at home, which I thought was cool, and he said, you know, he goes, this is really good. He goes, you could make a living doing this. And that was all I needed to know. And I quit my job at the theater, which was cool with Bert. And I had two kids at that time, two little girls. And we sold our house about 2 weeks later, and we drove to California. And that's how I got to California. So that's sort of the backstory of how I ended up from Florida to California. And then I got out here, and I got a job on a really bad sitcom, But it was fun because it was me and a guy named Mike Scully who were writing this thing, and Mike ended up running The Simpsons for many years and went on to do a lot of amazing things. But I wrote a one-hour script that got to the executives at Universal, and they responded to it, and it got me an agent, and they called, and they said, would you come in for just an overall meeting with us? And I went in, and I met with these guys, and it must have been every executive at Universal Studios that I met with that day. And they basically said to me, you know, we've got a bunch of shows we're producing. Is there anything that you might be interested in working up some story pitches for? And I had just seen Quantum Leap. I had just sort of seen it in the last couple of weeks. And I liked it because I liked the whole idea of what the show was about is if you could go back and change one moment in your life, how it would change everything in the rest of your life. And I always had thought about, you know, if I had just not gotten a car that day, you know, how my whole life would have been different. And that had always played in my mind, that what if scenario. And so this was perfect. This was like, I think I could get in touch with what I need to get in touch with to write the show. And so they set up a meeting with Don Belisario and the writing staff. And I went in and I pitched five ideas, and they responded to almost everything. And it was funny because they really didn't commit to buying anything, but I knew they liked me. And on the way out the door, Don said to me, he said, do you have anything else? anything else that you just didn't pitch, any loose thread of an idea? And I said, well, I have an idea about a circus thing. And I threw out the name of the family, the Flying Panzinis. And I don't even know where I came up with that name. But he started laughing. He thought the name was funny. And he went, that's great. He goes, let's do that one. And I was like, okay. So I worked up a story really quick because they were in a production bind at that time. They needed a script really bad. So I worked up a story, and they liked the story, and they said, go write it because we need this draft in a week. Well, I didn't know that was like, you know, I didn't know if he wrote a script in 3 days or 3 months at that point. So I said, well, okay, I'll get you a draft in 5 days. So I did, and I turned it in, and they called me the next day, and they asked me if I wanted to be on the show. So that was like how it started. It just was really fast and sort of that dream thing, you know, where you dream about if this could go as well as it could go, how would I want this to play out? And that's really how it happened. And that's how I wrote that first episode.
Wow, that is insane.
Yeah, it is insane, isn't it?
Did all those ideas you pitched eventually get made?
I think 3 or 4 of them did. They might have all become different versions of things, but, you know, what was cool was that Chris Rupenthal was really, he was sort of the head writer behind Don and Deborah, his wife at the time, Deborah Pratt, and Chris was really kind to me, and, you know, he, very encouraging, and I just came in and became a writing monster for those guys. I wrote a lot of material pretty quick for them, but I do remember the excitement of that first episode, Sleeping Without a Net, is the excitement for me was the first day we shot. You know, now I had an office on the lot at Universal. I had a golf cart that they gave me that was my own. And I used to just, you know, during my lunch hour, I would just drive around Universal. I would drive on the back lot. I would go back to, you know, I remember taking my little girls and climbing into the Psycho House and eating lunch on the floor with them. And, you know, I would just do all the fun things that you would want to do if you had access to the studio, you know. And I remember the first day we shot that episode, I went down, and it was like I might have cried even, because they had taken over the biggest sound stage on the Universal lot, which is gigantic. And they had built a circus. They had built a 1950s or 60s circus inside this soundstage, and I went down there, and there it was, the trapeze, the clowns, the net, everything. There's Scott in his outfit. There's all the actors. And I thought, man, I just thought this stuff up, you know? This came out of my head, and here it is, you know? And it was really, for me, it was my golden age of my television career, because, you know, it was before I became a showrunner. You know, later I ended up running series, and it changes because you got all kinds of responsibilities. But at this point, I was just a writing machine, and it was the most fun I ever had that first season and the second season, you know, when I started producing the episodes and casting and doing all editing and all the stuff that you get to do when they start to trust you. And that was the first time I went down to a soundstage and saw my imagination come to life. And I remember Scott coming up to me, and it was the first time I'd met Scott, and telling me that he was terrified of height and that he was like, you know, he wished somebody had run this by him first. And I said, well, I'm sorry, dude. And later, I remember later, I would actually, you know, after a while, we would start to try to put Scott into uncomfortable situations just to watch squirm. And I remember when I wrote Miss Deep South, and I had him in the bathing suit contest, and I went down to the set, and he's in a one-piece bathing suit with high heels, and he just looked at me, and he went, really? He goes, really? It's come to this? And I was like, hey, I go, we're working on one where you're a monkey, so just enjoy this, you know? So we had so much fun, and he was the best. You know, I've worked with a lot of actors and a lot of, you know, big-time actors, and Scott still, he and Dean are still the nicest two guys I ever worked with. They were just great, down-to-earth guys, and I'm sure Scott's still like that.
How did you go from a writer to, what was it, a co-producer to a producer or something like that?
Well, a lot of it's, you know, a lot of that is built into your contract, so a lot of it is just, you know, in lieu of a lot of money, we're going to call you something else. When you're a co-producer, you're still basically just a writer. It's just they give you a title bump every time your contract gets renewed. And the thing for me that was weird is that everybody seemed to love my work, but Don kept me on these 12-week contracts. So every time I would think I was really motoring along, my contract would come up for renewal. And, of course, it would always come up when I had a script due, and I would go to Don and I would say, you know, can't we make this a longer-term thing? And he goes, well, let me read this next script. And I always felt like I was constantly auditioning for this guy. And Don was a hard guy. I mean, Don had a reputation as a pretty tough guy to deal with. And he and I got into it. I mean, I was there. I'd been there about 2 months, and he and I got into it in a staff meeting. You know, there was probably 10 people in this little office, and he didn't like something that I'd written. And instead of just giving me a note, he got angry and he threw the script at me. He threw it at me across the room, and I ducked and it hit the wall behind me. And I had, you know, I don't play that with anybody, even at that point in my career. So I got really upset. The meeting broke up. I went back to my office and I sat, and Chris Rubenthal and Paul Brown, we were basically the writing staff at that time. Those guys came into my office and I had tears in my eyes, and they were just, I was angry. These were tears of anger. And I said, I'm not going to put up with this. I don't care if he fires me. I'm going to go in there and confront him right now. And they were like, don't do that. Just sit here. Just let it calm down and let it go, because you won't win. And I said, I don't care if I win. I just won't be able to ever look at myself in the mirror if I don't stand up to this guy, because what he did to me was wrong. And so I went into Don's office, and he was on the phone. I was sort of standing in his doorway, and he gave me, you know, like gave me the 1 minute sign, and he finished his phone call and he said, come on in. And I came in and I said, listen, I go, you can never treat me like that again. You can never do that to me ever again, or I'll quit. You know, I don't care if this is my biggest break, or I'll find another job, but you know, you can never treat me like that ever again. And he apologized. He said, I'm sorry. He goes, my mother's real sick, and I've been upset all day, and I took it out on you, and it won't happen again. And he and I were like tight from that point on the rest of my career there. So it was one of those moments that where I did what I had to do, and he fessed up to being wrong. And it really bonded us for the rest of my time there. But I, you know, my big promotion on that show came in the third season or the fourth season, when I became a co-exec producer on the show. And that was really funny. The way that happened was I was doing really well on the show. It was I think I just got a longer term contract. I was making really good money, and the show had been nominated for best series, and it was about as high profile as that type of series got, that sci-fi kind of genre at the time. So suddenly I came into my office one day. I had this really cool bungalow office on the lot, and I came in and there was a guy named Dick Wolf was sitting on my couch in my office. Well, Dick Wolf created Law and Order and like all those series, you know, and he was the other big monster producer on the Universal lot at the time, him and Don. And I was like, what are you? I'd never met the guy, but I knew who he was. And I said, hi, what are you doing in my office? You know? And he said, I came to offer you a job. And he'd come in the back door. He kind of snuck into the back door of my office. And he offered me a really, really good opportunity to come over and do a new show he was doing, run a new series he was doing. But he wanted me to come like now, like right away. He knew my contract. I could get out of my contract if I wanted to. And he offered me twice the money. And it was crazy. It was like, I couldn't believe this was happening. And I turned him down. I told him, I said, I couldn't leave Don. I said, if I left Don right now, the show would be in so much trouble, just because they need me right now to get this material out. I said, I appreciate this opportunity. I may look back on this, which I did later and sort of regretted it. I said, but I can't leave the show. So he thanked me, he shook my hand, he walked back out the back door. So later that afternoon, my secretary calls me and she says, listen, I don't know what's going on, but Don and the whole staff are coming down the hall towards your office. So I just want to give you a heads up. So The door, my door bursts open. I'm sitting at my desk working, and Don walks in, and he got all the writers with him, and he goes, he points at me, and he said, "You see this? This is the guy. This is the guy right now. You are my new co-executive producer." He goes, "Look at this man right here." He goes, "This is the kind of people I want on my show." So I didn't know what was going on. I honestly was just dumbfounded. So he turns and he walks out. Everybody follows him out. And at the time, we had a director, a co-producer guy named Michael Zinberg, who'd done a lot of our episodes. And Michael was standing there. I said, "Michael, what just happened?" And he said, he goes, "Don and I went to lunch today. And on the way out, Dick Wolf stopped by the table. And Dick Wolf told him the story about what had happened today with me. Told him he offered me the moon, but that I turned him down." And Michael said Don's chest kind of got real big, like he was real proud. And he goes, "You made the right decision." He goes, Don loves you like a son, you know. So that was how I got my biggest promotion ever in show business. It wasn't anything that I did. It was something I didn't do. I didn't take a job that was offered to me. So that was sort of a funny way. But that's how I ended up as an executive producer on Quantum Leap.
Wow.
Yeah, and then later, like the next year, Spielberg came knocking. And I couldn't walk away from that opportunity. So that's when I left Quantum Leap to go run Sequest for Steven Spielberg. But I still think that I had a great time doing a show called The Pretender for 4 or 5 years with the guys that ran that series. And that was a lot of fun. And I had a lot of freedom and a lot of power on that show. And I got to flex my creative muscles a lot on that show. But I have never had more fun than I had doing Quantum Leap, because it was just a time in television when we were just doing little movies every week, you know. I mean, Quantum Leap is one of those rare vehicles where you're not doing the same show ever twice, you know. We were literally making little movies every week with really no home base, you know. Our stories were always set in a different time, a different location, always a total different cast, except for our two leads. So, I can't even think of too many series that are like that now, you know, even today. And I still used to get goosebumps when that title sequence would come on. You know, the music, Mike Post theme, and just all the cuts and I just still, even when I hear it now occasionally, if I see a rerun or something, I get goosebumps, because it was it was the beginning of my career, and I look back on it very, very fondly.
A lot of shows come and go, but Quantum Leap's one of those things that's so special that I think it'll stick around for quite a long time.
Well, you know, we used to have the third year, I think, they started those Quantum Leap conventions, mm-hmm. and we even sort of laughed them off in the beginning as like, okay, there's a hardcore group of people and they like the show and they want to get together and talk about it, and that's fine. And then we ended up all going to one that they had here in Hollywood, and there was 3,000 people there, and people from all over the world, people that had flown in from Australia and Europe and wanted to meet us and as writers and talk to us, and it was. We all sort of looked at each other and went, wow, this is bigger, you know, because you can really lose sight of a show when you're, you know, basically hunkered down in a bunker creating this stuff, and you're creating it so fast because, you know, I used to call it the monster is feeding. And once you start filming a season, it doesn't stop, you know, it starts to eat material and it never stops eating it until you're done. And, you know, I laughed. I hired my son-in-law as a writer when I was doing a show called The Dead Zone. And he's running a show called Banshee now. And I laugh because they do like 11, 12 episodes a year per season. You know, we never did less than 22, 24. Yeah. So we were, you know, it was a grind. I mean, when you got to 15 or 16, you were out of gas and you still had 7 episodes to do in. And they had to be good, you know. So there was a burnout factor that happened. And then the show changed, you know. I mean, Chris left and Paul left. And then Rick Oakey and Jill came in. And it sort of took a turn. And I didn't really enjoy it that last year I was there. I didn't like the direction the show was going, and we were doing some things that were just odd. But I understood, because you run out of things to do. You know, you run out of ideas at some point, and you start to, you use up all the good ideas in the first couple, 3 or 4 years. So if a show runs 5 years, that fifth year, you're really like, what have I got in the bottom of the drawer that I wouldn't have used the first 2 years, you know? And then, you know, when I had a chance to go work for Steven and do Sequest, which was the biggest money series at the time ever created, that was just too good to pass up, even though it turned into a nightmare for me. But
I love that show.
Which show?
Sequest. I watched it every week.
Well, I was so excited to do it, because I was such a fan of Roy Scheider's, but Roy came in, and Roy wasn't a very nice man, or he wasn't nice to me. He didn't like me, and I really was, to be honest, looking back on it, over my head. I probably didn't have enough experience to be running a show like that, and we had creative differences, and I ended up leaving pretty quick, and then it just sort of did what it did. But I did the first. My only solace on that show was I wrote and produced maybe the first 7 or 8 episodes, mm-hmm. and then I left, and the show finally came on, and the critics got to watch the whole season when they did their reviews, and they wrote a review in the LA Times about the show, and they loved the first 6 episodes, and then they didn't like it so much after that. So my agent framed that and sent it to me and said, "Hey, you know, at least you kind of knew what you were doing. You know, you kind of creatively did a good job." But I just didn't have the, and I never really developed, to be honest with you, that ability to placate people, studios, actors, agents. I just don't have it. I tell the truth, and I don't suffer fools easily. And I burned a lot of bridges at studios with. Mostly studio and network executives, because I just didn't think they knew what they were doing, and I didn't like them telling me how to do my job. So I would get work, but I worked only because I was good at I was a good writer, not because I was a politician. I was a horrible politician when it came to that kind of stuff. But that's the problem with television, is the more successful you get in television as a writer, the further away from writing you get. Because, like, I ended up running Sequest, and if I wrote, it was at night when I went home, because, you know, I was picking costumes, and I was casting, and I was editing, and I was looking at set drawings, and I was trying to figure out, at that time we were trying to figure out special effects, CGI stuff, you know, which was, that was the beginning of it. We, you know, I remember spending months sitting in a room with these computer guys trying to figure out how to make it look like these guys were underwater, you know? Mm. And it was just, we were figuring it out as we went. And I really had no interest in that stuff, but that was my job. So the further you go up the ladder, the further away you get from what you really love to do and what I was probably best at. And that's sitting down and writing script. But that's, you know, that's what, they pay you so much money. That's why my agent used to remind me. I go, "How can they abuse me like this?" And he goes, "Do you see how much they're paying you? Because that's how they can abuse you. That's how they justify it." You know? And I was like, "All right, I get it."
But I can understand how it'd be more satisfying to be writing and being more creative than executive and making decisions.
Oh yeah, no, I was much happier writing, and that's why I say my happiest memories in my career, which was like nearly 25 years. Are of those first 2 years on Quantum, because I really was a writer, and that's all they wanted from me. They didn't even ask me to go to casting sessions or anything. Man, it was just keep these scripts coming, and those weren't easy stories to figure out in some respects, because you know they were all juxtaposed with time, and you had to come up with these little brushes with history, and each script had its own built-in challenges above and beyond even that basic storytelling you were going to tell with that story. I seemed to always end up, you know, when I did The Dead Zone, I felt very similar to when I was doing Quantum, because they were almost like algebra problems, you know, trying to figure out these stories of, you know, okay, if I go back and I change this moment, how's that going to How's that going to domino and change this for that character? And then how's that going to change the big picture in the world? And how can we do this? How can we make this really cool moment with, you know, the lights went out in New York and that was had something to do with it, or, you know, all these really cool little moments of connection, because that's really what the show was all about, was that connection to, you know, changing one thing to change everything. So, but that's why people love the show. That was the challenge. You know, we would always say to each other, God, if it was easy, nobody would like the show, you know? So, and I worked with really smart guys. You know, most of the guys I worked with went to Harvard. These guys, these were Ivy League guys, and I didn't even go to college. So I used to laugh at those guys. We would sit in writers' meetings sometimes, and I would go, where did you guys go to school? And they would go, you know, and they knew I knew where they went to school. And I go, and what am I? I'm like a high school graduate, and we make the same money. What a beautiful world we live in. And they would just look at me like, shut up, you know. But I had so much fun with those guys, and they were smart, really smart guys.
What did you do on The Dead Zone?
I ran that show for a couple years.
Oh, wow. With Michael Piller? Or is
with
it after?
Michael, I was there when Michael died.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they brought me in to take over the show. Well, that was an interesting story, too, because they'd hired a showrunner, and they brought me in to really run the writing staff, which that's what I wanted to do. I actually went in under the caveat that I was not going to run the show. I didn't have any interest in being the showrunner. I wanted to run the writing staff. So they brought me in, and then I was there for a month, and the guy that they'd hired to run the show freaked out in a pitch session with the network. We had to go pitch the new season, but I had come up with about 80% of the new season in the room, and we put it all together, and then they said, okay, well, you're going to meet with the network tomorrow. And I said, no, I'm not. I said, you guys, there's the showrunner right there, and I said, he's going to go pitch it. I'm not, I don't want to be the showrunner. I told you guys, I'm not good at this. So they were like, oh, okay. And so they went down the next day to pitch this to USA. Well, this guy just fell in the toilet during this pitch, this guy they'd hired to run the show. So they canceled the meeting. They called me at home that night. They said, it was a disaster. You need to meet with USA tomorrow and pitch the new season. And then so I went down the next day, pitched the new season. They loved it. And then the guy quit the next day, and I took over the show. So I ended up exactly where I didn't want to be, running that series. But Michael was very sick, and then, you know, so I felt a real obligation to do that show as well as we could do it for him. And then during the course of that year, he passed away, and it was really sad. It was a hard time. And I love those guys. The guy named Lloyd Segan, Sean Piller, his son, was on the show, and actually those guys hired me. I'm writing a pilot script for those guys right now. So
awesome.
Because I actually retired like 2 years ago. I couldn't do it anymore. I was doing my paintings, and I was playing music again, and I have a granddaughter now, and I was just really, I just didn't care anymore. I had just done it, you know. There's very few artists. I'm fascinated now by the idea of true inspiration, and it's an interesting thing. If you look at, you know, like music is like everything in my life. It's more important to me than anything except my family. And if you look at musicians, there's a lot of great musicians, but they're only really great for a short period of time. You know, they write three great records, and then it just leaves them. I mean, there's a few that have lasted over time, but inspiration is a really fleeting and ethereal kind of thing, and it comes and it goes, and I was able to keep it alive, sometimes artificially, but I was really able to keep it as a force for me to make a living for over 20 years. But after that, I just, you know, I did a show called Kyle XY, which was the last show I worked on before I quit, really, and just said I don't want to do it anymore. And that was a bad experience for me. And I just said, you know what? I just don't get it anymore. And I can't fake it anymore. I was faking it. And I was just dragging myself in every day. And I said, I have other things I want to do, you know, with my life. I'd made money and I was, you know, I didn't need the money anymore. So I decided that would be it. But then I took my pension, started painting. And then of course these guys call me and say, would you write a script? And I said, sure, I'll do that.
That's awesome.
I'm writing a new script right now.
Looking forward to hearing about it when it
gets picked up. I'm looking forward to figuring it out. That's sort of the story for me as far as how I ended up in the business.
Okay, I have some questions. I had a question about The Dead Zone. The number 47 always showed up in there. Was that a writer thing?
47. You know what? I don't think I came into the show till seasons down the line because I don't remember anything about the 47.
Okay. A weird question because it was that number popped up in every episode, so I wasn't sure. I know a lot of the guys on Next Generation did it, so it might have been a Michael Piller thing.
It probably was a Piller thing, but he was an interesting guy and just, really inspirational for me, and I was excited to work with him. I was sorry when he passed, but I went to his memorial, and there were so many great writers and basically sci-fi people there that were telling these amazing stories about him. So it was a really beautiful memorial.
He seemed like a genuinely nice person.
Really nice, kind of, really demanded a lot out of his writers and his staff, but that was okay. I always liked it when people expected, had high expectations of the work, and he did. But he turned it over to his son. His son is doing a really good job now and has a show called Haven that he's doing, and Sean's a really, really, really nice young man, and I enjoyed working with him too.
Cool. You worked on Odyssey 5?
Yes, I did work on Odyssey 5. It was that was an interesting time too, because it was a fun show. It was a really interesting concept, and I enjoyed working with. I had worked with on Pretender with Carlos Cotto, and then Manny Cotto had created Odyssey 5, and Manny hired me and Tracy Torme to do that show. Yeah, I think it only did 1 year.
Yeah, my big question for that is, did you guys know where the series was going to end up if it didn't get canceled?
Yeah, I think Manny did, but he didn't ever tell us, or he didn't really ever lay it out for us. And but I think it had to do with time travel and God, and it was real spiritual, whatever it was. But Manny and I had I don't like people messing with my work, and and Manny and I sort of had a falling out in the middle of that show over a episode I wrote that Peter Weller ended up directing, and everybody loved it. Peter loved the episode so much that he picked it to be the one he was going to direct, and I really worked really hard on the script, and then and of course he came in and started rewriting it, and I sort of lost my mind at that point, and that was sort of the end of the beginning for me on that show. But we sort of knew from the ratings that show wasn't going to ever see its potential. But it was fun. It was an interesting concept.
You've been involved in a lot of shows with interesting concepts, and mostly genre shows, which is awesome. It's like it seems to be your forte.
Yeah, but it's completely by accident, because it's not really where my heart was ever at. My favorite writer is Horton Foote. My favorite movie is Tender Mercies. I wanted to write, that was where my writing, where I wanted to go as a writer. I wanted to write really simple American human, rural kind of stories. And then I ended up in these sci-fi genres. But that was the beauty of Quantum, was you were inside a genre, but you could write all kinds of stuff, I could write a story like Killing Time, which is like one of my favorite Quantums that I wrote. And that's basically a little, dark murder mystery set in the country. It's Bonnie and Clyde. It's genre, but it's not, and that was the beauty of Quantum, because we were all so different, the writers. If you look at Paul Brown's scripts, Paul Brown's scripts were always very mystery oriented, always really, that's why he won a couple Edgars for the show. And they were always really sort of high concept-y mystery, and they always had sort of an element of Dashiell Hammond kind of thing going. Chris Rupenthal's scripts were always really smart and sort of I don't know, you know, really kind of high concept-y too, my scripts were always, or basically always, really sort of character-driven pieces, you know, a beauty pageant in the South, a legless Vietnam vet in a rehab hospital. You know, mine were always sort of driven by character instead of concept. And but we all had a place on that series, which was fantastic, you know. And that was why we sort of all, we never got in each other's way. And then we always supported each other really well. I think that's why Don sort of liked, and then Don would write these, you know, oh, you know, I want to turn you on. I had dinner the other night, a New Year's Eve party at my house, and we have the same people, eight of us every year for the last 20 years, and one of them is a guy named Joe Napolitano.
Oh, director.
Yeah, Joe directed a ton of Quantum.
Yeah.
And I want to give you his email address because he'd be happy to talk to you.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, Joe's, oh my God, do you know what Joe's done besides, I mean, Joe was first assistant director on Scarface. He was first assistant director on the Pope of Greenwich Village, on The Kingfisher. He's the amazing film career. And then, you know, just tons of television. But Joe directed a bunch of the stuff that I did. I don't think he directed Leaping Without a Net, but he did Heart of a Champion.
I did a little mini Tommy Thompson marathon last couple of days, and I noticed he directed a bunch of yours.
Somebody has to. Yeah, and then of course, everywhere I went, Joe came and directed for me, you know. And,
cool.
And, we worked really good together, and he's just a brilliant, he's got a brilliant eye, and he's, you know, he's just real creative and a cool guy to work with. So, yeah, I'm sure he's got a lot of things he could talk to you about down the line.
That would be awesome. I would love to talk to him.
But, yeah, I don't know how I ended up in this sci-fi genre thing, but it just feeds on itself. You know, that's what you get to be known as. So that's the job offers that you get. But, you know, for me, I was always like, why won't somebody just, you know, I'd just love to write for Picket Fences, or I'd love to write, you know, for some other little show that doesn't have a sci-fi bent to it. But
nowadays that seems to be the thing. Everything has to have something special about it. Like,
different. Oh yeah. Right. Well, I'm surprised, you know, I'm surprised that they haven't done Quantum again in some way, shape or form. You know, you could really update it and make it just as interesting, because there's, you know, I think that enough time has gone past that you could do it with a younger cast, a younger version, and make it a real hip show. But, they'll do it. Somebody will do it somewhere.
I'm hoping it'll happen one day, about the time we're finished going through all the original episodes, so we can keep going.
Yeah, exactly. Then you'll have some new binge watching to do.
That would be great. Everybody seems to want to, but it's just a matter of getting it done, I guess.
Yeah, I don't find, you know, for me personally, the binge watching thing, I did it, I watched The Wire that way, because I hadn't watched The Wire, and everybody was watching The Wire. And for me, maybe it's because I've been in the inside of creating TV shows and series like that, that I don't think shows are meant to be watched like that. Because if you watch them, when I was watching The Wire, I had this sense that I was watching the same episode over and over and over again, you know? And then I realized, well, it's supposed to be a week going by between these episodes. So there's, you know, you have to write a little bit in a way for people to catch back up. But if you watch them back to back like that, you don't get that sense of missing any time, so it feels repetitive to me. So maybe people are creating series now to be watched that way. I don't know.
Maybe like House of Cards, thing specific like that.
I just actually watched a series called The Missing, which I really enjoyed, on Stars. It was really good. As a BBC, I think, sort of, you know, one season mystery, and I sort of enjoy that format of like one season and then it's over kind of deal, you know.
Makes it more special almost.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, it's like, okay, I'm not going to have to commit, you know, my entire next part of my life to this, but and then I can sort of watch them as I want to watch them on these sort of on-demand channels, which is, you know, everything is, since we did Quantum, think about how the world is different now. Mm. You know, I mean, we didn't have the internet really to that extent then. You know, any research we did, we really was, you know, we had to go look, hunt it down. And so, you know, now it's, the whole process is different. But I look very fondly on those days.
Can we go through the episodes you're credited for writing and just give me a little
Yeah, I'll give you what I can remember about it. Okay.
We're talking, of course, about Leaping Without a Net.
Yeah, that really, like I said, came from like the funny name of the family, and Don laughed and said, go develop a story around that. And I think I went home and watched like every circus movie, trying to figure out what to do. And the funny thing about my career as a writer is I had a really sort of a difficult relationship with my father growing up. And at some point, like, I'd written maybe 10 Quantums. My wife was like, did you ever notice that a lot of your shows are about fathers and sons, mm-hmm. or fathers and daughters, or that sort of parental thing? And I said, no. And I looked back, and they were. And it was subconsciously, I found that a lot of my stories had to do with that. They were healing stories, you know, like mm-hmm. like people healing things that had gone down over time in families and stuff. So it's interesting how you can sort of psychoanalyze your own writing after a given period of time. But I look back at a lot of those stories, and a lot of them had that sort of same theme.
I noticed that with Future Boy and Play Ball.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they all had that sort of broken relationship, sort of wanting to heal kind of thing. And I'm sure that came out of some deep, you know, need or desire myself to heal myself and my own relationships with my father and stuff. But that's how I worked it out, I guess, you know, because I never, you know, a lot of people in the world have psychoanalysts and they go therapy. And I never did. I wrote it all out. You know, I played it out in these make-believe characters and stuff, and worked a lot of stuff out in my own head that way. But yeah, a lot of those are, if you look at them, they're kind of similar in what's going down.
Tell me about Leap of Faith.
Well, Leap of Faith didn't end up being one of my favorite episodes, but it was, you know, it was another. A lot of those stories would start with us sitting in a room with a, you know, pens and index cards, just coming up with things that Sam could become, you know, like a boxer or a killer or a bathing suit model or a priest. So we'd always had priest up there, and priest sort of, you know, people would pass it by. And finally priest kept coming around, and it was like, okay, you got to go develop a story about Sam as a young priest. And then I'm a big sports guy, and I thought, well, if I can connect this to boxing, and then I really liked, we cast a young actor in that I really liked, a guy named Danny Nucci, mm-hmm. who played the young kid in that part, and I was really taken by Danny, and so I enjoyed writing for him. And you know, it was just another episode that you try to find. The thing I remember about that episode, Jimmy Whitmore, I think, directed that, and Jimmy was one of our go-to directors and a great guy. His father was James Whitmore, a very famous actor. And Jimmy had been an actor, had been in a lot of TV shows in the 70s. But there's a train sequence in that. It's a conclusion of that where he's supposed to get run over by, the priest is supposed to get run over by this train. And I remember we found this train, but they wouldn't let us run the train over like 5 miles an hour. So I was like, how are we going to create any drama of this train bearing down on this poor man if it's only going 5 miles an hour? You know, it was like the scene from
Austin Powers. Yeah.
Yeah, where mm-hmm. he's trying to run over the guy with the steamroller. it became that thing, you know, where so we had to sort of do a lot of editing cheats mm-hmm. and we had to speed the film up. And it was just that. I just remember that was my memory of that episode, was the nightmare of trying to make it look like that train was going to do any damage to anybody at all. So that's sort of my memory of that episode.
That's funny. It worked because it looked like it was going to do something.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's magic. It's Hollywood magic.
Yeah. Miss Deep South.
Yeah, that was fun. That was, you know, again, I'm from the South. A lot of my family are Southern. And it was just, you know, I also always liked comedy in my stuff. And that was a great chance to do Sam, and it's just one of the most uncomfortable leaps of his life, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just the whole talent show sequence where he's doing the Carmen Miranda number and with Dean. Mm-hmm. And I remember shooting that and how much fun those guys had doing that. And that, you know, Scott was Scott was a musical guy. He'd been in musical theater as a young man, and how much he enjoyed. Anytime we could give him music to do, he liked it. And it got to the point where if you could give him a story that had some connection to reality and had some meaning and a payoff, he didn't mind doing the outrageous stuff, you know, because he knew that that was part of the appeal of the, you know, when you did your Oh Boy leap in, it better be something compelling to bring people back, you know. So he didn't mind doing that stuff, but I have very fond memories. My memory of that is going down and watching the photo shoot where they were doing the, they're sort of in the middle of the story. There's a compilation of photos where the girls are all lined up and they're holding each other up in the air and stuff. And I was there that day when they were shooting that, and just how much fun and how much trouble the crew gave Scott that day. It was very funny. And how uncomfortable that one piece woman's bathing suit was.
He seemed like a good sport about it, though.
Completely. Mm. I don't remember in my time there him ever calling or getting a call from the set saying Scott won't do this, you know. Yeah. Ever. Yeah. So, you know, and he could have thrown his hands up at a few things and said, you know, I'm not wearing a diaper, you know, but he didn't. He knew what we were doing, and he signed on, and it was popular. So, you know,
What was the process like for you, doing a story, like breaking a story like that? Because usually an episode will have, like, he's in a beauty pageant, but then there was also a secondary thing to where someone was in jeopardy, or maybe there was a...
Well, that was, I mean, the world that you let them in often was just that. It was just an arena to tell a smaller story, you know? That story was about a girl who was being sexually abused by a pageant director, and it was about, that's what it was about. So, you know, you wouldn't want to tell a frivolous story in a frivolous world.
Mm-hmm.
But if you set a really important sort of topical story about sexual abuse, and you set that in the world of pageants in the South and the 60s or the 50s, then, you know, that's a pretty interesting marriage and something that you're not going to see anywhere else, you know. And it also gives you a place to let the air out, you know. You can have fun, and then you can turn that moment into something really serious, and that's great drama, and that's what Quantum Leap did better than anybody.
Did you ever feel like a sense of responsibility to always put like a moral lesson in every episode? Because there seemed,
yes,
it always seemed to be about something, which a lot of,
yes,
television isn't.
Don drove us to do that. We wouldn't have done an episode that didn't have a meaning or didn't have a lesson or a moral or tell, you know, some sort of human story. We just wouldn't have done it. It wouldn't have been interesting, you know. I mean, one of my very, very favorite episodes ever was an episode I did called Future Boy. And to me, that was the perfect Quantum Leap because it was set in this fantastic world of live television in the 50s. You had this crazy character who was trying to now build a time machine. And then at the end, you know, that last scene in the movie, you realize this guy got his idea from Sam, but Sam got his idea from him. So it was like this entire circle of the series. I mean, I remember Don reading that script and saying to me, man, you just brought it all back around. And I said, I know, isn't it? It's fantastic. But I wouldn't have been able to do that in any other place except in that setting, you know, with this crazy character. But at the end of the day, it was about a father and a daughter. It was about a parent and a child that had been broken and that were trying to heal each other. And so, you know, again, it was like, it was all the fun of the craziness of this man, but then it was a story that everybody can relate to. Everybody's got a mom and dad. Everybody's got a family. Everybody's got a broken relationship somewhere in that mix. So yeah, it was, and like I said, mine more often than not were about family. More than even the other guys. The other guys would tell, I believe, more, you know, mysteries and detective stories and stuff. Mine usually came down to family.
Future Boy, did you get that idea all at once, or did the story develop in your head over time?
Yeah, that one came really fast and easy, and And once I had the leap in, and I realized I sold them on a man that was building a time machine, and then I think Don said, you know, I think in my original story the machine didn't work, you know, it had no chance of working, and Don said, you know what, you should make it so that it for just a second it looks like he might leap, and like he's almost there, and that to me was the key to it, because then, you know, he revved this machine up, and then Sam and Al are standing there, and this thing starts to sputter and spark the way you're familiar seeing it, and then it stops and it breaks down, and you realize, wow, this guy was like close. This guy might have gotten there, you know, and so that was sort of, and a lot of that stuff was for you guys. A lot of that stuff was for the people who paid attention and the people who loved the show and knew the connection between episodes. And, you know, so you had a lot of balls in the air doing that show.
That was a great moment, because that's the moment you knew he wasn't crazy, that if he just had a little bit more time, he might have made
it. That's right. Like, everybody thought he was crazy and they wanted to commit him and stuff, but no, he was actually onto something. And that's why I loved it. And I also loved that episode because my best friend growing up as a kid is a man named Dave Chase. We're still best friends. And at the end, I used his name and I said, "This letter from little David Chase from," and so I didn't tell Dave. And Dave watched, and Dave got a big kick out of that.
That's awesome.
So that was fun. Yeah.
I noticed in at least three of the episodes you wrote that Sam was on television while he was leaping in, either in a soap opera, pro wrestling, or on Future Boy.
Yeah, even in Killing Time, he was the wanted on the TV screen. So, it was a great, you know, it was a great device to kind of sell period, you know, to let people, because you could use commercials, you could use period sort of a style, the way things looked, the different period. So TV worked really great in my mind to sell that, to instantly visually sell that, whatever period you were in. And so it was a device that I went back to a lot. But that was another favorite of mine, the episode with the soap opera episode with Pruitt Taylor Vince and Moments to Live. Yeah, I had fun writing that episode too, because it was crazy. You know, I mean, here you have a woman who kidnapped a soap opera star to impregnate her, but then you think her husband is there to kill him, but he's actually in on it. You know, the husband's actually going along with it because he's nuts, you know? And Sam's like, "Oh my God, I'm trapped with some psychos here." But that whole, the fun of that soap opera world, and then juxtaposed with this couple that just want to have a child. They just want to have a family. And again, goes back to family for me, because family is everything with me.
Was that episode Moments to Live when the woman thought that he was a doctor and couldn't separate the actor from the character? Was that at all like a commentary on what was happening in real life?
Exactly. And I cast this actor, Pruitt Taylor Vince, who he's done a ton of movies since. Mm-hmm. But when I cast him, he's a real interesting actor, but Pruitt has a affliction. I don't know what they call the situation, but his eyeballs move back and forth very fast. He can't stop them. So he doesn't drive. And if you talk to him, his eyeballs are like moving constantly, like vibrating. And I just thought that's the craziest and most interesting thing I've ever seen. So, and he was a really good actor. He's a great actor. So that was really fun working with him and putting them in it. And I like Southern Gothic sort of rural craziness, you know, and that's where I come from. And the South, I think I use the South a lot in my stories.
Is it fun to put little things in the episodes, like naming her Norma Bates?
Yeah, that's stuff that keeps us interested, you know, like how are we gonna slip in fun, these little fun moments, you know. Sometimes they're just for us. Sometimes they're, you know, they're names of friends, they're names of family. That's one of the privileges of creating the world, is sometimes you can populate it with people from your life, and that's sort of the fun of that.
We talked earlier about, of course, you being in a wheelchair for a while, and when the mother falls asleep in the wheelchair and is spinning, I laughed out loud at that part of the episode. Was that something that came from real life, or you just thought that would be funny?
Oh, yeah, no, that was a guy when I was in rehab, there was a guy who used to drink. He used to drink like his aftershave. and he would just sit in this chair, this electric chair, and spin around, and nobody would bother him because he would pass out. and so I just used that. I used everything. I mean, you know, that episode about the legless Vietnam vet.
Nowhere to Run,
who I named after my father-in-law, who just recently passed away, Ron Miller. And that episode had a lot of stuff that was from my life and from my time in the hospital. And there's a scene in the pool where he's talking about trying to sabotage his relationship with his fiance because he doesn't want to have her have to live this life of a burden with him. And I live that, and I've watched young men do that to their girlfriends in rehab because they didn't want their girlfriends to stay with them because they didn't want to saddle them with that life. And so all that stuff, I saw and lived all that stuff. So you only write what you know. I mean, you can only make up so much until and when it feels false, you know. You have to really write the truth of your own life. And so that's what I did. That's why I think people liked my writing. And that's why I think I became a pretty decent writer, is because I had lived such an intense life, you know. I mean, when you go away at 15 and you live with a bunch of legless Vietnam vets and you see a lot of things and experience and hear and a lot of things that you wouldn't normally experience. So I came at writing with a full bag, you know. I had a bag full of stuff to tell, and I found it pretty easy to do.
In the fan community, Quantum Leap fans, Leapers,
right?
There's always, and even when you read descriptions for episodes on different things like Netflix or something, there's always a confusion whether Sam Beckett's body leaped or just his soul, and if it's just an aura around a body. And Nowhere to Run is one of the episodes always cited as the example of Sam walking without legs,
right,
being able to walk. Things like that. Was there a rule book, like he can do this, he can't do that, or were you making it up as you went in accordance to each story?
There was a rule book. It was a rule book that lived only in Don's head. And when you would write scripts, because we were constantly wondering about that stuff ourselves, so we would write moments, and if he believed it or if it passed muster in with him, then it worked. If it didn't, you'd go back and figure it out in a way that it would make him happy. So in a lot of ways, that rule book only lived within him. But I think you're right. I think that in some ways it was almost like his soul got ahead of his body, and maybe his body was chasing him around too. But it was always a little complicated, especially in scenes like that, you know, where sometimes I think we would push the envelope a little bit. And a lot of times, I'll be honest with you, you guys knew and thought more about it than we ever did, you know, because I remember being at that Quantum Leap convention and they had a trivia contest, and Paul Brown and I were sitting over on the side, and we didn't know a lot of the answers, you know, to these trivia questions. And I would look at him and go, man, we got to look into this because we don't know enough about our own show. These people know more about this than we do. But that's the fun of it, you know. People, and a lot of times it's interpretation, so let people have fun with it and think what they want. And as long as it's entertaining, it worked for us.
And 25 years later, we spend 3 hours or more on each episode discussing it in detail, so who would have thought that was going
to happen? Yeah, well, hey, but look at that. Isn't that what they talk about, like the Beatles?
Mm-hmm.
When you can dissect the Beatles music and find all this really cool sort of innuendo in it, and then you go ask the Beatles and they go, no, we were just writing a funny story there, you know. So that's the beauty to me of creation, is that it means different things to different people, and if it's done well, it'll mean something special and something different to every person that watches it, you know. A different interpretation. I mean, did you see the new film, Birdman?
No, not yet.
Yeah, well, when you go see that, tell me what the ending of that movie means.
Okay.
You know, I mean, and I've talked to 3 or 4 friends of mine who saw it, and we all had a different version of what that meant, of the ending of that movie. And then I read where the filmmaker said, I wanted everybody who watched the movie to have a different idea or their own idea of what happened at the end of this movie. So sometimes that's the idea. Sometimes the idea is that there is no one idea. There is no one perfect way to interpret it. It's like what it means to you. And I think that's what art is, you know?
Exactly. That's what art is.
Yeah, at the end of the day.
Have you ever had somebody come up to you and talk about something you've written and gotten so much out of it and then thinking to yourself, I had no idea when I wrote that that could have meant that?
Yeah, a lot of times, you know. I mean, I would get letters from women, mostly women, who had watched episodes that had helped them, empower them in some way, or, you know, to leave their husbands or to stand up to abusive relationships. And you were like, wow, that was like deeper than I even ever intended it to be. You know, I'm happy. I'm glad that it struck somebody in a way like that. But yeah, it's always a surprise that, hey, look, I'm surprised that you guys are even talking about this still. So, it makes me happy, and it humbles me and to think that we did something that was kind of cool. And
it was special. It really was.
Yeah, and it still lives. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I appreciate you guys even being interested.
Thank you.
Yeah, if you want to, hey, I was telling you I had some art. Mm-hmm. You should go check out, anybody on Facebook can go check it out. It's called, the site's called Electrified Mojo, and you can see all my paintings on there. And I'm really proud of them. They're whimsical, but they're pretty cool. I think you guys will like them.
Yeah, I'll put a link up on our website and let people know about it.
Cool.
Okay, let's go Southern Comforts.
Oh yeah, well that was the one I was telling you about that I would get letters about, people like, you know, that had been women that had been in abusive relationships and had stood up. And at the end of that one, you know, the woman stands up and fights back. And so that's another one where, you know, it started out as one concept-y thing, and then it became a much more powerful story than even I anticipated. And that was, you know, I used to tell writers that in the beginning of creating a story, it's work. But there's a moment when you click into a story when it starts to work, when it doesn't become work anymore, and you really just become a transcriber of what it needs to be, and it really, the story begins to tell itself to you instead of you having to make it up. And so that, when I came up with that sort of abusive angle on that, then that story really clicked for me, and that's when everybody got interested in, let's do this. It'll have a meaning, you know.
Heart of a Champion, to me that's a special one because I'm involved in pro wrestling myself.
Oh, really?
And you got a lot of the stuff right for back then. I mean, before movies like The Wrestler and stuff that really said what the business was like.
Yeah. Well, I grew up watching wrestling, and the kick for me is I got to hire Terry Funk.
Yeah, that was awesome.
To come in and be, and Terry Funk is one of the great, not only the great wrestlers of my youth, I grew up watching wrestling, Gordon Solie and South Florida Wrestling, and Terry Funk and his brother were world champions out of Texas, and so I got connected with Terry, and then Terry came in, and Terry turned out to be like one of the nicest, sweetest, down-to-earth, quiet, humble guys you'd ever want to meet. And then he'd turn the camera on, and he'd be a maniac. You know, I mean, that scene where he bent the locker over his head, he improvised that. Well, nobody asked him to do that. He just grabbed that door, ripped it off, and bent it over his head. And we were like going, oh, my God, if you stop rolling the camera on this, you know, we're going to fire somebody here today because that. Yeah, that was fun. And my friend Joe directed that, and I got to hire, actually, I think I put Ron Howard's dad in that episode.
Wow.
Yeah, his dad plays the doctor.
Okay.
In that episode.
Yes. Rance, oh, now I recognize him, yes.
Rance Howard, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm also a fan, you know. I mean, I grew up, I'm a movie and TV fan, so it was always a joy for me to hire people that I knew who they were, or I knew their connection to the business, and so it was a joy to put Rance in that episode.
I was at a local wrestling event, and a guy actually had a heart attack and died in the ring. So that
really?
Does happen, yeah. Very scary.
Oh, I'm sure it does, and I'm sure those guys had no medical coverage.
Oh,
I'm
nothing.
Sure they didn't take care of themselves. And Terry used to tell me stories, you know, about, you know, broken legs, mm-hmm. bones, and you know, injuries that they'd wrestle through. And yeah, so it was just a way, again, it starts with a great leap in, you know. Sam's leaping in, he's in a ring, and he's being thrown across a ring. Oh, the fun part of that too was the day we filmed Sam getting pile driven, and you know, we were going to debate whether we were going to do a stunt double or not. And Terry assured Scott that he would not hurt him, that he could pile drive him and make it look good, but it wouldn't hurt. And Scott let him do it, and they did it over and over again, and they had the best time. They had so much fun.
In high definition, you can definitely tell it's Scott, and I was amazed because those are some moves that they were doing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, but we had Terry Funk, man. We had the world champion there, and he was going to – and he took complete care. And, you know, I said, all you got to do – you just have to do the ring thing for me where you bounce off the ropes, and then you stop real quick and make that face. I go, you just got to promise me you'll do that. And, yeah, I was there all day when we were shooting that wrestling stuff. And we had this great sound stage, and my friend Joe Napolitano directed that and just shot it, just shot a beautiful sequence on the wrestling.
It's entertainment, but at the time, a lot of people didn't know as much as like they do today about it.
Right.
Is that why there was the story part where if it was a championship match, it was a competition, not entertainment, maybe?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I didn't really write it for people who knew that much about wrestling. You know, I sort of wrote it for the Quantum Leap fan that may not know that much about wrestling, but it was also a more innocent time of wrestling, you know, like the 50s and the 60s. You know, now it's big show. It's you know, it's big characters and you know, it's almost like, oh, it's so over the top now. But back then it was like, you know, the Russians, they were the bad guys, and that was it was good versus evil, and that was really what we were shooting for, and the idea that these Russian bad guys were just actually American guys who were just pretended to be Russians.
We still have those today.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. I'm sure everything's not what it appears to be, and that's, you know, and that was sort of the through line of everything we did on Quantum Leap was nothing is what it appears to be.
In Killing Time, it's one of the few episodes that we see the future. Were you entirely responsible for the future world, or was that like
a
collaboration?
Wow. Yeah, I was. And that was a real risk. That was like coming out of the box a little bit from what we normally did. And again, I think we were at a point where we wanted to start pushing the envelope a little bit. So creating that futuristic world was both a challenge, and I'm sure in hindsight, it probably looks a little cheesy now, but we had fun doing it. And I remember when Al went to, and there was the stripper thing, we shot that on a soundstage. Michael Watkins was our DP. Michael is now executive producer of The Blacklist. And we shot that. He did it handheld. We had this real stripper come in, and she stripped. And I've never before or since that day saw Dean Stockwell come out of his trailer between shots. I turned around, and Dean Stockwell is standing right next to me, smoking a cigar, watching this shot be done. And it was the funniest thing I ever saw. I said, oh, hello. I said, what are you doing out here? And he's like, what do you think? And so he shot that entire stripper thing handheld on the stage with her. It was amazing to watch. It was to watch him work. And it was cool. It was cool kind of giving Al something interesting to do, you know? It was always a challenge to get something for Dean. It wasn't just him being like a parrot, you know, like or just a signpost. You know, here, Al, here, Sam, I can tell you this and tell you that, and then he's gone. I think Dean was looking for a little bit more to do, and I think that's where we came up with that episode.
It's a really good one. Was there ever a debate whether or not to include the date of 1999?
Yeah, I don't remember. I don't remember any date. I think we did it. Gosh, I think we did it because we didn't want to cross the threshold of a new millennium, and it was like far enough out where it was, well, you know, we can sell that it's going to be futuristic, but we don't have to go too far out. Plus, we had to keep it within the lifetime, you know.
Was there any unwritten law of how long his lifetime was? Because a lot of times you went to the past, but didn't go to the future in the five seasons.
Yeah. No, we didn't talk much about the future as far as their lifespan, but we did have a cutoff as far as how far we went back in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we ventured much past the late 50s ever. But, you know, that was always the last thing we thought about when we were working up these stories. That was like, you know, you'd work up a great story and then somebody go, yeah, but, you know, we can't go there because of this and that. And it was like, oh, gosh, you know. Let's change the rules, you know, but Don would never let you change the rules. Mm. But I think, you know, I think it got weird later when we did like a Civil War story.
Yeah.
And that's when I was sort of like, you know what? I don't think I want to be around here anymore. This is this is getting too weird even for me. And that I was ready to move on by then.
Two of the episodes you did, Future Boy and Deliver Us From Evil, are probably fan favorites from amongst a lot of fans. What can you tell me about Deliver Us From Evil, and where did you get that idea?
You know, I think it was, well, John's my friend. John's the guy that I drove to California with the first time I came out here with, and we're still really good buddies. But that was just, that came again wanting to push the envelope and do something really darker and twisted. And again, I felt like that one for me, we went a little too far with that one. I mean, we might have broke our own rules with that one in a way, and it was okay. It was just, it got a little bit of soap opery for me at that point. And I think my better days as an episode creator were behind me then. I think that one and probably Blood Moon are probably my two least favorite.
Blood Moon is pretty infamous.
Is it?
A lot of people mention it when they're trying to...
In a good way or a bad way?
Not so good.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine they did. It was not one of my favorites. I don't remember what was going on in my life at that time, but I think I might have been having some issues in my personal life that I was distracted and I, you know, it was that thing of, okay, it'll be fun. We'll leap him in. He'll think he's a vampire. That's fun, but then he can't really be a vampire because there's not really a vampire. Mm-hmm. So he's going to have to be involved with some sort of weird cult, and we're going to have to make them realistic enough to be scary, but it just had so many problems when you started to break it down. And to be honest, the writing is just not really great in that episode. So that, again, I started to see, no pun intended, the handwriting on the wall for me was like maybe I had emptied my bag and I needed to go do something else at that point. So yeah, it happens.
I still think it's a good episode.
It's okay. I always get a laugh at the dialogue in that when the girl says that they found her in a boot box. And Don thought that was the funniest line he'd ever heard. He was like, in a boot box? I go, well, he goes, what's a boot box? I go, it's a box boots come in. Somebody put her in a boot box. And he was like, okay. He just shook his head. And I was like, I knew I was in trouble when that was what he was picking on.
Mm-hmm. Promised Land?
Yeah, I liked that episode.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, I mean, again, rural, you know, that sort of all-American crime story, but it's about a family and, you know, it's about what's happening to these people and how they get pushed to the limit, and sort of spoke to a time in this country when, you know, a lot of farms were going under and people were having to do things that they didn't want to do and getting their backs up against the wall. And I liked that story. I liked telling that story.
Was it your idea to have Sam's dad in there?
Yeah, it was, and that was, anytime we could do that kind of stuff, Scott played the heck out of that. And, you know, I think we may have made a mistake using Scott as the father and putting him in the makeup and stuff, because I know we went around and around about that, and it's maybe, I think Scott really pushed, he wanted to do it as an acting thing, and at that point, he'd earned the right to do whatever he wanted to do. But I think if I had more strength of character in myself, I would have pushed more to put another actor in the role. But it, as it worked out, and the way it got shot and revealed, it was just nice. You know, it was, mm-hmm. Again, I think, you know, every once in a while, we did those episodes for you guys because it was important that we not forget that this guy, Sam Beckett, also had a life at one time, you know, and that he'd left that life behind And that, wow, here he was actually jumping back into that life for a moment. It was like, you know, it was like, I'm sure one of the favorite moments for the fans is Imagine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he sang Imagine to his sister.
Yeah, I cry every time.
I think it was his little sister, wasn't it?
Yes, I cry every time I see that scene.
Of course. We did too when we saw it. And again, Joe Napolitano shot that episode. But that was Don. Don usually saved those episodes for himself, and he usually wrote those episodes at the end of every year, and they always turned out really special, but I guess I stole one from him. I stole the father. But yeah, it was fun. It was nice, and it was, again, it was a little bit low concept for our show, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while, we do a little bit of low concept, high concept, which was, you know, sort of my strength was like simple stories, simple characters, and, you know, and then of course I did Blood Moon.
When we had John DeAquino on the show, he talked very highly of you, and he mentioned about
I gave him a lot of work.
he mentioned The Beast Within and how you and him kind of worked that out together.
Yeah, we did. He had shown interest in writing, and he wanted to maybe try to, you know, acting's a hard thing, and he knew writing's more lucrative in a lot of ways, and so I wanted to help him, and I had the muscle at the time of the show to get him a script assignment, and as long as I took responsibility for it at the end of the day, and so we sort of created that idea together, and then he wrote it, and I probably did a polish on the script. And I don't ever think he wrote anything else that I know of, but it was fun. You know, sometimes you got to have fun in the job, especially if you're in charge and you find yourself with a little bit of power and you can do some things you want to do. So that was something I wanted to do. I wanted to let my friend have the fun of writing an episode. And so we did that together. It was fun.
What do you think of what ended up being the series finale of the show?
I think that my feeling was that you were in a no-win situation there. It's like any great epic series. It's never going to end the way everybody wants it to end. And it's never going to be all things to all people. I mean, I was a huge Sopranos fan. I happen to be one of the people who sort of dug the ending of Sopranos. But there's a lot of people who love that show who were just so turned off by the way that show ended. Well, you have to end it somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Don ended it the way he wanted to. All those characters in that final episode meant something to Don. You know, they were creations of Don's and things that were important to him in the life of the series. So that's how Don wanted to end it. And he was the man who created it, so he had the right to do it how he wanted to do it. I thought it worked as well as anything else could have worked. I mean, there's a lot of people who would have wanted to be more final, you know, like more definite, but I don't know. What was your feeling about it?
Oh, I liked it. I loved it.
Yeah.
Some people don't. I don't get it, but everybody sees art differently, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And everybody has different expectations about something before it comes, you know? I'm one of those people, I love movies. I go see everything. I mean, my wife laughs. She goes, "You'll go see bad movies." I go, "I just love movies because mm-hmm. I know, first of all, I love sitting in a theater and the lights going down and like, okay, here comes something that I don't know. And I like that experience. But I am one of those people, I tend to expect a lot, and I'm always disappointed. So, you know, even movies that are supposed to be great, I go see them. Now, if you tell me they're going to be really great, I go see them, and they're not really, really great, I'm disappointed. So people that put their time and effort into watching that series, they may have these greater expectations than what's realistic. But like you said, you liked it. I'm sure there's a lot of people who really liked it. So, you know.
I noticed some things in your episodes that might have been like a repeating motif. That two things I noticed was people jumping out of windows and Sputnik being in more than one episode. Do you have things that are like you always try to sneak into it as like a signature, a hidden signature in your writing maybe?
For me personally, no. I mean, if anything, I always liked to use music in my stories, and that was one of the, you know, the great things about, like, at that time, we had a pretty good music budget on Quantum, and we could get away with things like, you know, like I got to use a lot of Dylan music, and, you know, that stuff cost money. And, you know, later on when I did shows like the Dead Zone and stuff, they couldn't afford to use real source music like that. So, I mean, I have a funny story real quick about, I was doing The Pretender, and I'd written this really poignant episode, and I cut it in the editing room to the Sarah McLachlan song, and it was beautiful. I mean, it was like every time somebody would see the cut, they would cry, and it was just fantastic. So we got to where we were going to lock the picture, and my producer called me and said, you know, we can't afford that song. And I said, what do you mean? They go, well, we don't have it in the budget for that song. You're going to have to find a different song. So I went back, and they gave me these temporary music cues to put in it, and nothing worked. Nothing worked like that song. So I said, well, all right, I'll get in touch with Sarah McLachlan. So I found out her address, and I wrote her a letter, and I put a cut of the show in, and I put that scene in, and I said, I go, you don't have any reason to give me this song for free, but if you think it works in this episode, I wrote it listening to your music, and I cut it to your music. And she wrote me back, and she gave me the song for free.
Wow.
So, yeah, so that was cool. But when we did Quantum, we still were able to afford really good music. So I liked using music in my episodes a lot if I could. And I liked humor, but I also liked to find a moment where it was just where I could just tear your heart out, you know. So that was always important to me. Don, when I first came on the show, Don said, the three H's, which were heart, humor, and history. I had it up on the wall in my office, and that's what I strove to get into every episode, heart, humor, and some history. So that was my mantra as I wrote this show.
Well, job well done with that, because my heart was torn out multiple times watching this series.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
You mentioned stories towards the end of the series having to pull out of the bottom of the drawer, but was there ever anything that you wanted to do but couldn't do, or maybe have thought of since that you wish you would have done on Quantum Leap?
Well, there was a lot of stuff, you know. I mean, we would have liked to have taken him back to the Old West, you know. We would have liked to have taken him back to, you know, I would have liked to have left him into a caveman scenario. I mean, you know, there was all kinds of stuff that you just couldn't go back far enough. You know, the only way we did the Civil War thing was we connected it through some sort of bloodline genetic thing that was just a cheat at the end of the day. But we always wanted to go back further, you know, into the Revolution and into, you know, the Prohibition. And I would have really had a great time writing, you know, stuff from earlier decades. But we had a big window. We had a 30 or 40 year window that we operated in, and that was pretty cool. And then along the ways, you know, we found various tricks to get our future out there in ways. So we sort of were constantly maneuvering around our own rules. But we, you know, we kept in mind always that there was an audience that had expectations, and they didn't, you know, it was sort of like, you know, you made the rules, you got to live by them. And so we sort of sucked it up, and we were okay. We did what we had to do.
If you ever had the chance to write for a new incarnation of Quantum Leap, would you do it?
Oh, yeah, I would. But, I think that time has passed. And, you know, I used to say, it's funny. I remember one day Chris Rupenthal wrote an episode about a mummy, Hotep. And I remember he and I and Paul Brown were standing on the soundstage. And it was huge. They built this giant pyramid and interior, and it was beautiful. And I looked at those guys, and I said, man, I go, these are the good old days, boys. I go, it's never going to be like this again. And even then, I knew that. And so I look back on those times very fondly from a production standpoint. You know, we had some really amazing artists working on that show behind the scenes, directors of photography and art designers, costume people. I mean, more than even most series, we had a lot of veteran Hollywood people working on that series. So I was really honored to be a tiny part of that whole process. And it was our time. But I think if they did it now, they should probably do it with a whole new group of young writers and a group of younger actors and get a new energy in it and tell it from a whole new perspective. I think it deserves a fresh look.
Me too. Thank you so much for talking to me today. Thank you for sharing your story.
Yeah, no problem. I appreciate it. And I really appreciate the fans that are still watching and that you guys have invested, you know, your emotions in the show. It's a big payoff, even this many years later, for a guy like me. And I love you guys all for doing that.